headlines, the Israeli Prime Minister steps up his rhetoric against Iran as the head of the International Atomic Energy Agency visits Israel. The war in Ukraine enters its 100th day, with the Russian forces pressing ahead with their offensive to take more areas in the eastern Donbass region. And the U.S. says China is challenging Europe's security and economy, asking European states to help Washington counter competition from Beijing. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, is on a visit to Israel, where he has met with Prime Minister Naftali Bennett. Iran has been the main topic of their talks. No images have been released from the meeting. Israel has issued a statement saying that it prefers diplomacy on Iran's nuclear program, but the statement added that Israel will take action if the international community fails to stop the program within, quote, the relevant time frame. The rhetoric comes despite repeated warnings by Iran against any Israeli act of aggression. Bennett has hosted Grossi 4 days ahead of an IAEA Board of Governors meeting on Iran. Britain, France, and Germany, all parties to the 2015 Iran deal, plan to present a resolution urging more cooperation from Tehran. The U.S. has voiced support for the resolution.
And we can confirm that we plan to join the UK, France, and Germany in seeking a resolution focused on the need for Iran to fully cooperate with the IAEA. It is essential that Iran does fully comply with its legally binding obligations under the NPT and separately with its comprehensive safeguard agreement with the IAEA without further delay.
Tehran has already warned against any unconstructive act at the Monday meeting of the IAEA Board of Governors. It has promised a strong and proportionate response. Iran has time and again said that its nuclear program is for peaceful purposes. The country says it's signatory to the International Non-Proliferation Treaty, criticizing Israel for refusing to join the agreement. The latest developments come as talks over the revival of the 2015 Iran deal await a final decision. Tehran says Washington should make that decision. The 2015 accord ran into trouble after the U.S. withdrew from it over 4 years ago. John Bosnich is a journalist and activist. He says the International Atomic Energy Agency is helping Israel against Iran, while the regime itself is a violator of the IAEA rules.
The International Atomic Energy Agency, in its own description, says that it's an international organization that seeks to promote the peaceful use of nuclear energy and to inhibit its use for any military purpose, including nuclear weapons. The IAEA was established in 1957, and the very next year, 1958, Israel started building its Negev bomb development site for nuclear weapons. Rafael Grossi is now visiting Israel, a country which is in violation of the IAEA rules, which has developed nuclear weapons. We all know the story of the international hero, the Israeli nuclear scientist Mordechai Vanunu, who in 1986 published documents that proved that Israel had an active nuclear weapons program and possessed functional nuclear weapons. That's 36 years ago. 36 years ago, the IAEA has done nothing about Israel. And now we hear that the IAEA and the United States and Israel are pressing Iran.
People in the Iranian city of Karaj, along with military officials, have gathered to honor Shaban Nasiri, a senior Iranian military commander who was killed by Daesh terrorists in Iraq in 2017. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Before Shaban Nasiri stepped on a Daesh explosive booty trap in Iraq 5 years ago, he had been barely known to the Iranian public as a pivotal military commander. But it's the fifth year in a row now that people in his hometown, Karaj, assemble on June the 2nd to pay tribute to the former commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, referring to him as a forerunner of the fight against terrorism and a flag bearer of security in the region.
At the end of the war in During the Iraqi war on Iran in the 1980s, General Nasiri held key positions and offered valuable services to protecting Iran's soil. After the war, he did not sit on his laurels and rushed to the Iranian eastern borders to help fight drug smuggling. And finally, when he saw that the region was plunging into chaos triggered by Daesh terrorists, he went to Iraq and Syria to combat the terrorists, where he finally was martyred.
General Nasiri was a senior commander in the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps' overseas operation unit known as Quds Force. He was a key advisor to the then Quds Force commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, who was assassinated by the U.S. in Iraq in 2020. Nasiri stood shoulder to shoulder with General Soleimani in the fight against Daesh terrorists in Iraq and Syria. He was killed at the age of 59 during the liberation of the Iraqi city of Mosul from Daesh.
Shaban Nasiri played a key role in recapturing Mosul from Daesh. I was witness to his efforts there. Late General Soleimani likened him to martyr Jahan Ara, who liberated Iran's city of Khorramshahr from Iraqi forces in the 1980s Iran-Iraq war.
General Nasiri was a founding member of the IRGC, and especially the Ba'ath Brigade, formed in 1982 with the aim of fighting Iraqi forces during the Iran-Iraq War. The Ba'ath Brigade once again rose to prominence in 2014 during the fight against Daesh terrorists, when Iran offered advisory military support to Iraq's army.
Here, they call Shaban Nasiri a living martyr. They say they continue to remember his name as an anti-terror military commander who lost his life to let the people of the region live in peace. Yusuf Jalali from the city of Karaj.
Yemenis have filled the streets in the northwestern city of Sa'ada to protest against the continued Saudi-led aggression against their country. Demonstrators chanted slogans against Riyadh. They also chanted death to America, condemning the U.S. for supporting Saudi Arabia in the ongoing war. The conflict began 7 years ago. The U.N. says hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed directly or through indirect causes such as hunger. The world body says Yemen is now the world's biggest humanitarian crisis. Numerous ceasefires meant to ease civilian sufferings have failed in the past years. The latest truce took effect in April this year, but Yemenis have complained about repeated violations by Saudi Arabia. The war in Ukraine entering its 100th day, with Russian forces now tightening their grip on the eastern Donbass region. The situation is tense in the city of Severodonetsk. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky says the region and nearby communities are the hardest hit. He also says about one-fifth of Ukrainian territory, including Crimea and parts of Donbass, seized in 2014, are now under Russian control. Zelensky has called on his Western allies to supply more weapons. Russian forces are fighting Ukrainians in the south, too. At least one person has been killed and several others injured in a Russian shelling of the city of Mykolaiv. That, according to Ukrainian officials. Earlier, we're joined by our correspondent, Johnny Miller, who is stationed in Donetsk, to give us more details on the situation.
President Zelensky said a couple of days ago that between 60 and 100 Ukrainian soldiers were dying every day in the Donbass, which is a staggering number if that's true. Russia, of course, has air and artillery superiority. The Donetsk People's Republic said that they will complete their encirclement of troops around Severodonetsk and Lysychansk in the next 3 days. So it's really troublesome times for the Ukrainian military. I've also heard reports that some Ukrainian soldiers tried to retreat from Severodonetsk, but they're sent back by their commanders to try and make a stand. The Ukrainians have tried to ask NATO, particularly America, for more heavy artillery. That's what they think they need in order to stop the Russian advances. But it's very hard for the Americans to get their heavy weapons even to the front. Russia is hitting railways and weapons depots all over Ukraine. Yesterday they hit a major tunnel in the Lvov district, which is where many of the weapons have been able to get in, a major railway tunnel. So it's very difficult for these weapons to even get to the front. And if they do get to the front, they're a target for Russian air and artillery themselves.
U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman says China is challenging Europe's security, economy and values. Sherman says China's actions matter for the future of Europe. She called on the continent to help the U.S. counter competition from Beijing. The U.S. diplomat also said her country remains vigilant over China's partnership with Russia. She added that China will see consequences if it sends military equipment to Russia. Beijing in the past has denied such claim. It has repeatedly called on the U.S. to stop smearing China's domestic and foreign policies. One such claim came last Friday when Beijing hit back at a speech by the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He had accused China of seeking to reshape the world order. Political commentator Andrew Leung says Europe needs to take a cautious approach towards China, considering a trading partnership with Beijing.
Of course, the U.S. wants Europe to be on its side against China. As I said, that there are commonalities as far as values, Western values, are concerned. But after all, China is Europe's largest trading partner and is the center of the global supply and value chain. Europe does not necessarily want to push the envelope too far, let alone starting a direct war with China. After all, the competition between China and the United States is not military, it's in the field of economics. And China is now the second largest economy in the world, soon to overtake the United States as perhaps the world's largest. So I think that Europe is likely to adopt more nuanced kind of approach.
More people falling victim to gun violence in the U.S., where calls are growing for tighter gun control. In the last incident, a man shot dead two women in a parking lot at a church in Iowa. He then turned the gun on himself. In Wisconsin, two people were injured after a man opened fire at a funeral. The shooter is now at large. The Thursday incidents are the latest in a series of shootings that have rocked the U.S. in the past weeks. President Joe Biden has now called on Congress to take action and impose tougher gun control measures.
We need to ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. And if we can't ban assault weapons, then we should raise the age to purchase them from 18 to 21, strengthen background checks, enact safe storage law and red flag laws, repeal the immunity that protects gun manufacturers from liability, address the mental health crisis, deepening the trauma of gun violence and as a consequence of that violence. These are rational, common-sense measures.
Biden's proposed measures have historically been blocked by Republicans in Congress. Gun safety advocates have pushed the president to take stronger measures on his own to curb gun violence, but the White House wants Congress to pass legislation. Just 2 weeks ago, an 18-year-old opened fire at an elementary school in Texas, killing 21, many of them children. An independent research group called Gun Violence Archive has registered at least 230 mass shootings in the U.S. so far this year. The British Queen is holding a 4-day platinum jubilee to celebrate 70 years on the throne. Thousands of festivities and street parties are planned, but not everyone will attend, with some calling for Britain to get rid of its royals. Many have even taken to social media saying the Queen Elizabeth should be the last monarch in the UK. Hashtag abolish monarchy has already been trending. On the streets, billboards with the same content have been set up too. A group calling itself a republic also plans to hold an anti-monarchy conference online on Saturday. Now, that is the third day of the Queen's Platinum Jubilee, believed to be costing £15 million. The heavy costs have been a source of discontent among the Brits. This has added to a series of scandals involving the royal family members. Surveys show calls for ditching the monarchs is particularly high among younger people. The French government has effectively declared that the existing economic woes at the country will last for years. Inflation has been unprecedented and may not be over until 2024. That could cause major problems for the recently re-elected President Emmanuel Macron. Ramin Mazahari reports from Paris.
France's government has warned, don't expect inflation to return to normal until the end of 2023. At nearly 6%, French inflation is the highest since 1985, and the government says the peak won't even be reached until this winter. It's a stunningly serious diagnosis. Inflation has seemingly been the number one voter complaint since the euro currency was introduced in 1999, and now it's worse than ever. Many are pointing the finger at the pan-European project, with Brussels demanding austerity and forcing Paris to ignore mass protests and public opinion.
This inflation is a symptom of the profound crisis caused by the policies of neoliberalism put in place since the 1980s. Above all, the policies seek merely to enrich stockholders and create constant dividends. This inflation is going to last, and the government is only making a wild guess that it will end by 2024.
Across the EU, only Malta has managed to keep inflation lower. France has been saved by its constantly derided socialist-inspired measures, such as caps on energy prices. However, many are demanding more price caps, re-indexed pensions, immediate bonuses, higher wages across the board, and especially for low-wage workers, in order to keep inflation from making the poverty rate skyrocket.
All the countries of the European Union are basically already in a recession. The 2008 financial crisis was followed by a forced era of austerity, which created a structural lack of demand and investment in Europe. Making massive public investments with efforts to an ecological transition would create both jobs and demand for goods and possibly avoid another Great Depression.
80% of France says they're watching their expenses more carefully, which seems likely to push France's consumer-driven economy officially into a recession next quarter. 70% are distrustful of their economic future, which is record pessimism so soon after a presidential election. After all the austerity, the French are being told to expect nearly 2 years of widespread economic hardship. That may not only affect this month's legislative elections, but it could lead to major social unrest yet again. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Defense of Iranian combatants.
A senior Iranian lawmaker has said,
contrary to Washington's claims, America's
President Raisi has emphasized that
U.S. sanctions have failed to extract concessions from Tehran.
Iran Today.
It was in 1979 that Iran's semi-modern monarchy was upheaved by a full-scale Islamic revolution, with the clerical school taking the reins of rule. 43 years later, the father of the revolution is being commemorated, 33 years on from his demise. Imam Khomeini passed away at almost 90 on June the 3rd or Khordad the 14th in 1989. The anniversary falls to June the 4th in 2022. The ceremony has traditionally been held in his mausoleum between Tehran and Qom since it was completed in 1992. It's not the mausoleum I've brought you to, however, but the Imam's living residence. That's at the other end of Tehran in leafy old Jamaran, north of the capital. What thoughts might the Imam have planned to put into practice from these very premises? For some answers, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. His thoughts he voiced years before the revolution, since 1962 and 3, which is what sent him into exile. But he returned from Paris with a religious doctrine 1st of February to seal the revolution on the 11th of February or 22nd of Bahman, 1979. The latter is marked as Revolution Day. Rather, Islam was to be the supporting ideology behind the government. Reasoning for this claim is based on the fact that the Imam put the matter to the people's vote, a referendum, so to speak, asking if they wanted an Islamic Republic, yes or no. Our guest, Mr. Fawzi, however, disagrees about the Imam's intentions altogether.
The late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, maintained that an Islamic government must be established. He also held that Islam has provided not only the general outlines in the area of politics, but also the details. The question is, given that any system of governance requires a set of laws and a ruler, are there any teachings in Islam about the structure of government that is legislation? Imam Khomeini's answer to this question is yes, as religion dictates that the Islamic rules and laws must be enforced in the society. Therefore, the process of legislation in a Muslim government must be based on the Islamic rules.
The Imam's vision of what his religious rule would look like if it materialized can be deduced from his address to the youth of France. It was France that he returned to Iran from, riding on revolutionary calls rising over Iran's horizon. Here's how the Imam put it. We want to implement Islam, at least Islamic rule, in such a way that you understand democracy as it should be. Be it that all learn that democracy exists in Islam in a form very different from what is claimed to be democracy by presidents and monarchs. It is noteworthy the Imam's religious doctrine was not anti-Western per se. He believed in adopting Western technology and teachings to adapt to Islamic Iran's needs and beliefs. This is similar to his belief that politics must pass through a spiritual sieve, that is religion, Islam to be specific. The revolution's achievement went beyond, however. The state is an Islamic republic, and all three powers are today principalist, although the president and MPs are elected by popular vote. This is the most recent development, however. Otherwise, over the past 2-3 decades, the country has been somewhat alternating between principalists and reformists for presidents. And finally, it elected a moderate Rouhani, the president, just before Raisi. Mr. Abu Talebi is of the clerical rank Hujjat al-Islam. As an authority on the matter, he noted relevant flexibilities and red lines.
Within this religious framework, we seek to use human wisdom and experience. Nothing goes wrong if you use, for instance, foreign electronics engineers, economists, artists, or sports coaches. We have so far used foreign experts in domestic sectors. For instance, we have used the French in the domestic automotive industry or experts from other nationalities in dam building and oil industries. However, it's not acceptable for us that a party believing in the separation of politics from religion come and conduct political activities such as entering the country's presidency or holding a seat in the parliament. It's not possible as it's in contradiction to the principles of Iran's constitution.
It is true that soon after getting a foothold in Iran, revolutionaries received blows from east and west, as they recall it. Blows to all sectors, economic, political, military and security. After all, a fundamental motto of the revolution was neither east nor west, Islamic Republic, with chance against outside influence from either end of the globe. Mr. Taraqi was an MP who's seen the inside of a jail cell pre-revolution.
Imam Khomeini maintained that among the most important reasons for the slow progress of Muslim nations across the world and bids aimed at preventing developing countries, particularly the oppressed nations in West Asia, from becoming stronger were the global hegemony, the world order created by major arrogant powers and the monopoly of power retained at that time by communism under the Soviet Union and the capitalism under the United States.
The Imam's anti-imperialist, anti-colonial approach changed Iran's political status in the region. Anti-oppression freedom movements anywhere were inspired by his ideas, such as the Islamic resistance movement.
The Americans say that after the victory of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution, we were worried that Iran could be more dangerous to the Persian Gulf littoral states than the Soviet Union. Prior to the Islamic Revolution, they added, we were constantly concerned about the possibility that the Soviet Union would orchestrate coups in the Persian Gulf littoral states and help governments come to power with approaches close to those of Moscow. But after the Islamic Revolution, we were afraid that governments, such as the one in Iran, would be formed in these countries.
After what Imam Khomeini did, new thoughts have been formed and promoted across the world and in the region, as a result of which practicing religion has gained greater popularity. The Islamic Awakening movement was formed, Islamic groups have become more active in Muslim countries, and Shias have managed to end their isolation, as you can see in the case of Houthis in Yemen.
As for national achievements since the revolution, they are a sign of how national self-confidence was given a boost or played on. Iran's revolution moved the country out of the West camp, so to speak, putting an end to the amicable, although not terribly balanced, trade balance between Iran and the US. This, in turn, was cause for greater caution on the part of the Islamic Republic, as well as its effort to progress.
The Iranian nation's success in foiling the plot hatched by the enemy to occupy Iran within 1 week and continuing the war for 8 years were proofs that Imam Khomeini had managed to, by creating self-confidence in people and increasing their spiritual power, strengthen the Iranians' will to an extent enabling them to stand up to and resist all these problems, pressures and difficulties.
Islamic rule with democratic-style elections was a threat to capitalist and socialist ruling formulas. A country run as such with scientific potential could be a role model to other states. And scientific independence for any third world country of the time would threaten global markets and big bucks of the powers. America was one of Iran's two great trade partners at the time of the revolution. The other partner was West Germany. Already extensive bilateral trade relations between Iran and America peaked in 1978 when imports from the U.S. were over $3.5 billion and Iranian exports to the U.S. were just under $3 billion. The imbalance was mostly in the nature of the exchange. But powers politics didn't leave it at that. With about 50,000 Americans living in Iran, the U.S. exported technology, industrial equipment, and agricultural and consumer products to Iran. There was a period when Iran, a sufficiently fertile land, notably imported 50% to 75% of its rice, wheat, and cereals from the U.S. This is while a year before the revolution, as much as 98% of Iran's exports to the U.S. were oil exports, with non-oil products making up just 2% of the total. Iran's was a single-product economy dependent on oil resources, after all.
Imam Khomeini also maintained that basically within the international system, countries have been placed next to each other in an unequal and unbalanced manner. There are states with great power and countries that are subordinate and inferior to them. In addition, the relationship among these countries has a hegemonic nature, an instance of which is the United Nations Security Council, where a number of powerful member states have veto rights. Thus, Imam Khomeini was a critic of the existing international system. At the same time, he would say that Iran has to have a smart interaction with other countries based on its national interests. It means that we need to retain our relations with those countries that have equal and just relations with us and stand up to those states that seek to dominate us.
America is establishing various factories and making a great many investments in this country automatically left little room for localizing many products. But America couldn't get enough, and what way to make even bigger bucks than arms sales? No harm in stashing up weaponry, of course, on Iran's part, given rival Arabs to our south and west and an almighty Soviet Union to the north at the time. But that's when you can use those weapons, when you find yourself short-handed under unwarned attack. But with the revolution and Americans leaving, Iran was at a loss. Well, it would have been had it not been for self-reliance and a national effort to reverse-engineer military equipment given us without the manuals. Only the American man on board to guide military personnel through the motions step by step, as our guest tells.
Iran, you know, before the revolution,
prior to the Islamic Revolution, Iran had the world's fifth most technologically advanced army. For instance, the United States only sold its F-14 Tomcats to Iran and Israel and no other country. We possessed the most advanced technology. However, our army and military equipment were managed by American advisors. Thus, during the 8-year 1980 to 1988 Iraqi-imposed war, we faced problems in terms of using the equipment in Americans' absence and could not overhaul the fighter jets and were incapable of preparing them for takeoff and flight. Under those circumstances, the country's air forces were compelled to get involved and work out solutions.
But today the country is keeping up with the world's latest technologies, namely in the design and manufacture of destroyers, radars, cannons, missiles, and anti-cruise ships. It doesn't stop at the military industry. Iran has advanced in a range of sciences. Say by 2017, it ranked fourth in ISI Index nanoarticles. This country has designed and mass-produced more than 35 kinds of advanced nanotechnology devices. And let's not forget the fight against COVID-19 and Iran's crop of homegrown vaccines.
After any revolution, a number of people naturally part ways with it and some others join it. Today, the number of those who have joined the Islamic Revolution is far greater than those who have parted ways with it. At present, we see that many young people take part in our religious ceremonies, which is not comparable to the turnaround attracted to such rituals some 20 years ago. We're currently exporting elites and experts as the domestic market's capacity is full.
More coming up, but first a quick media review to see what other outlets have to say. Here's how it looks in writing. The New York Times has a small analytical piece predicting the length of revolutions, looking at their nature. Iran's system keeps its grip despite the chaos, or because of it. Governments rooted in revolution like Tehran's have proved to be among the world's most stable, even drawing strength from crises. Iran's new government faced isolation abroad, turmoil veering on civil war at home, and a devastating war with neighboring Iraq. But it has endured and sometimes created a string of crises of the sort that have felled far wealthier and deeper-rooted governments. The longevity has defied the assumptions of experts, foreign adversaries, Iran's own citizens, and seemingly the fundamental laws of history. As stabler-seeming governments falter or fall at a rising rate worldwide, the mystery has only deepened. A growing body of scholarship may shed light on Iran's against-all-odds resilience. New research finds that it belongs to a small club of nations whose systems have proven some of the most durable in the world, those formed out of violent social revolution. They include Cuba and North Korea, two other American adversaries that frustrated decades of efforts to topple them, as well as China, Vietnam, Algeria, and several others. Their average lifespan is nearly double that of other systems, and their odds of surviving beyond 30 years is nearly quadruple. The Washington Post has posted a piece by George Nader, editor of the Middle East Insight, a bimonthly magazine that covers contemporary Middle East affairs. Now, the significance is this. George Nader, in the early days of the revolution, found himself amidst a meeting of regional heads with Imam Khomeini present, so he got a close-up view of the Imam's life. Here's what he said. At home with the Ayatollah and his men. During a reporting trip to Iran, I was unexpectedly invited to see Ayatollah Khomeini. The encounter occurred at Khomeini's quiet home in Jamaran, a small village on a mountain just north of Tehran. The visit offered a rare portrait of Ayatollah Khomeini as he talks with friends and supporters, quiet, religious, critical of the Soviet Union, rather than the bombastic personality familiar to Western audiences. Seeing Khomeini in this setting was especially valuable for me as a Christian whose cultural and religious heritage varies so widely from that of the Islamic Republic of Iran. I was the only Western journalist present. The other visitors included leaders of the Afghan Mujahideen, some senior officials of the Lebanese Shia militia Hezbollah, and some Islamic fundamentalists from Egypt. The visit with Khomeini was a reminder that for all the strategic importance of Iran, the motivations of its leader remain intensely religious. Although charismatic and clearly in command, Khomeini is detached from worldly objectives. Where most Middle East leaders live like kings in splendid palaces, Khomeini still lives humbly. He remains devoted to his cause, which is Islam and Allah. That'll be it for the news section. Iran's was an ideological revolution and therefore knew no material borders, only spiritual ones. Hence, the Imam's call was not only for national unity, but for Islamic unity and even world unity against world tyranny. Islamic unity in the form of the pro-Palestine Quds Day March is a notion and entity put into motion by the man who took power at 80. Quds or Jerusalem Day is the last Friday of the holy month of Ramadan when Muslims refrain from eating, drinking and self-indulgence from dawn till dusk. Here are the Imam's own words. Quds Day is an international day. It is not a day just for Quds. It's a day of the oppressed standing against the oppressors. It is a day of resistance by all nations suppressed by American and non-American despotic superpowers. The Imam understood the depth of the issue. As a man of jihad, he took it to heart and called for a movement in defense of the people of Palestine and the world's oppressed. That was none other than the Quds Day March. His relevant writings had two main points of focus. Those were resisting the great despotic powers and aiding Palestine and standing against its usurper Israel. The Imam had hardly landed back in Iran that the Palestine-Israel crisis passed his lips. Cancer must be attended to as soon as possible, and to the Imam, Israel was a cancerous growth.
From the very first day after the formation of Israel in 1947, the fight against the regime began in Iran. But what the late founder of the Islamic Republic, Imam Khomeini, did in this regard was that he emphasized that Palestine's issue is the Muslim world's top priority. It means that based on his protocols, Israel seeks to occupy the area stretching from Nile to the Euphrates and has just started this project. We, however, have to nip the plan in the bud, for as Israel manages to occupy the entire Palestine and stabilize its rule, it will proceed with this project.
The Imam meaning leader, called on Islamic world leaders and supreme clergy to adopt unity and to prevent differences from growing among the Islamic Ummah. With Muslim unity, he pressed, India would no longer have its eyes on Kashmir. Foreign efforts are to prevent unity, in other words, to loot underground and overground resources of Muslim lands. The concept of divide and rule would prevail all over again. To prevent this, unite to fight oppression and rise as the victor. Iran, in its quest for change, did serve as a regional role model, and in the first couple of years after the revolution, Islamic countries were a scene of praise for the Islamic revolution, expressed in articles and sermons.
The pure Islam promoted by Imam Khomeini and today elaborated on by leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, is far from an extremist form of the religion that favors violence and a reactionary one incorporating dogma. Therefore, the Muslim world is at present witnessing a constantly strengthening inclination toward the Islamic Republic, as well as the political thoughts of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei.
But when the West saw nothing can sway revolutionary Islam, which was spreading elsewhere, it created the likes of Daesh. Beside every Shia enclave, a radical Sunni, no Takfiri group, would have to sprout. This bears the question, how are we West Asians going to handle our region as united Muslim states with a message true to the original Islam?
If the freedom of speech is promoted in Muslim countries and they allow these thoughts to be propagated freely in their territories, a movement will begin toward an ideological and political unity in the Muslim world.
Talking of unity and peace and unity, Iran's constitution calls for political and cultural unity among different branches of Islam. Sunni Muslims in Iran are active members of this country's parliament, representing predominantly Sunni areas, as are the recognized religious minorities, Zoroastrians, Jews, and Christians. Also, in the Assembly of Experts, which is responsible for appointing Iran's leader, there typically are Sunni clerics among members. That'll be all for today. Thanks for showing an interest in a turning point in this country's history, one that stretched beyond Iranian borders, both physically and spiritually. Do tune in again at the same times next week and each week after, and bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Supplication is the wealth of the believer and the bridge by which one achieves proximity to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the Exalted.
A path to salvation, a way to connect the two worlds. On the program, Bridge.
Oh,
You're listening to the program Bridge on RIB English Radio with Sheikh Al-Musavi.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان اللعين الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program Bridge. In this program, we look at the supplications of Al-Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn al-Sajjad, Salamullahi alayhi, which are found in the book As-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah, supplication number 8, verse number 1. The Imam asks Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and he seeks refuge in him from a number of vices. And we got up to vice where the Imam says, قِلَّةُ الْقَنَاعَةِ, lack of contentment. Now, contentment is of a great importance and has profound impact on a person's life. As a person achieves such contentment, it will have an effect on his well-being, on his psychological well-being, as well as his physical comfort. That's why it's important for me and you to try to get and gain this contentment in this life, and also frees people from the bondage of matter, the enslavement of greed, and it extinguishes the suffering and the humiliation of being needy and wanting things from people and wanting things from this world. It also opens a door where a person has his own pride and dignity, where he is no longer in need of things. He is no longer in need of people. And he's being above petty matters. You know, because as we get this kind of contentment, we elevate ourselves. The more we see ourselves needing, we are degrading ourselves. Let us take a short break, and then we continue right after.
A path to salvation. A way to connect the two worlds.
The bridge between Allah and His creation.
A bridge that is meant to take us to Allah, to take us to His proximity. A bridge that is in the form of dua and supplication.
In this program, we offer commentary on the du'as of As-Sahifat al-Sajjadiyah of Imam Sajjad alayhi salatu wasalam.
The famous book of litanies, the Psalms of Islam.
Bridge.
Rabbana, Rabbana, Rabbana.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge. So we were saying the one who is content with the substances in his life, which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given him, has indeed a calmer mind, and he is more calm and stable than the one who is devoted to pursue wealth and to pursue worldly matters. And obviously with such pursuit comes worry, with such pursuit comes sadness, with such pursuit comes fear, because sometimes you make money and you want to make sure it's safe. So you're constantly worried about stock markets dropping, constantly worried about the currency and the value of the currency. So constantly these things, material matter, cause us to constantly have all these problems. Where those who are content are much happier, much calmer. So contentment provides the person who has it with this enrichment, with this inner wealth. He becomes wealthy and rich from within, because the reality of wealth and the reality of richness is in the mind, what you tell your mind. So some people, you might find them having absolutely nothing, but you find them the happiest people on the planet. And those who have everything, you find them the most miserable people on the planet. Why? It's because of their mindset. They're just not happy. They're just not content. So from here, we understand that being content is a very important part of our lives, that our well-being, our physical, mental well-being depend on the notion of contentment. So it becomes evident in a person's life that for him to be free, for him to be, at least in terms of thinking, in terms of dealing with people, in terms of dealing with other things, he's free. He's not a prisoner. Because we become prisoners by the bonds and by the chains we put on ourselves when we become uncontent with what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has given them, which He has given us, which in fact is a disease. Therefore, we need to shift our lives and our reality into something much better, something worth having. Inshallah, we'll continue after having a short break, so please stay with us.
Listening to the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program Bridge from IRIB English Radio. So we said it's important for a person to be qana, to be content, because our happiness in this world, our happiness in the hereafter is based on it. And when we look at the hadith from Amir al-Mu'mineen, the famous hadith where he says, "La kanzu aghna min al-qana'a," there is no treasure more valuable than contentment, because we said contentment itself, it means certainty and belief in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. It means strong faith. Having strong faith is the most valuable thing in this world. When that thing becomes weak, when that thing becomes feeble, I could lose my iman. I lose my iman, and then obviously I'm heading towards the wrong direction in this world and in the hereafter. So to have that contentment is to have that iman in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And then the Imam alayhi salam, he continues and he says, Al-qana'atu kanzul la yufna. If you have contentment, it's a never-ending treasure. So belief in iman is a never-ending treasure, which means Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala will give you more and more and more. Why? Because you are content. So the more content you are, the more you believe in iman is stronger, which means it will take effect on our life. The person's, a mu'min's life, is always a fruitful. He's always giving. He's always producing. He's always, you know, adding something extra to life, rather than him being an extra on life itself. So a person needs to, you know, change his mindset. Look at the problems that he faces, and he needs to get to the root of it. And sometimes, if not all the times, the roots and the, you know, the foundation of all our problems is ourselves, is our mindset. Amir al-Mu'minin salam Allah alayhi, he says, "A'wanu shay'in ala sulh an-nafs," the best thing to fix oneself, he says, "Al-qana'a," to be content. So to fix all your problems is to be content. When I look at people and you see how miserable they are, even though when they're having the best of everything. Recently, I was in touch with a sister. She has a beautiful husband, a very religious husband. She has two beautiful kids. She has a house. She has everything that any woman would want. But she says, "I'm not happy. I want to leave the house. I want to, you know, go and be alone." That's lack of contentment. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Al-Musawi in the program Bridge on IRIB English Radio.
هرگز نگیرد تا ابد آقا کسی جای تو را هرگز مخواد از کف دهم عشق و تولای تو را
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.